Good afternoon, this is Elliot Litt, number one. We're here with Ara Sharanian, poet of Los Angeles.
Hello.
Hi, Ara.
Hi, guys, thanks for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to be on the show. I'm Matt Timmons, and this is
Stephanie Ryu.
And we're going to talk with Ara today about his book, Series in the World, which is coming out on Factory School at the end of this year, right?
Or next year. Small okay. Presses, you know.
Okay. Ara Sharanian is the editor of Make Now Press of Los Angeles. They've published Raymond Fetterman's Precipice and Other Disasters, Ian Monk's Family Archaeology, who's from the Oulipo School in France, and Kenneth Goldsmith's The Weather, his most recent book. And you can find all those books on Small Press Distribution at www.spd.org. Ara also runs a reading series at The Smell in Los Angeles with Stan Apps, who is here in the audience tonight with Tova Cooper and their soon-to-be son, Leo. And
I think he is already their son.
He is already their son, that's true. and also, Ara Sharanian is putting out a magazine called The New Messes, which will come out, I believe, in November. And it's going to be an amazing anthology coming out twice a year, featuring writers such as Charles Bernstein, Kenneth Goldsmith, Jerome Rothenberg, Mike Keith, Raphael Rubinstein. Who else?
Oh, Craig Dworkin, Darren Wurschler Henry, Bill Kennedy, a lot of LA poets, Jen Hopper, great. Bruno Mori, Jane Sprague from Long Beach.
Great.
Leslie Scalapino is going to be in it. Juliana Spar is going to be in it. Lots and lots of names. William Moore. The great William Moore.
Yes, the great William Moore. And that's, okay, so Ara, you're doing a whole lot of stuff. Can you tell us about kind of maybe what you, I don't know, talk to us about what you're doing kind of with publication, with literature here in LA in general?
Well, I think the press started when I was asked to edit an experimental literature anthology, which 2 years later turned into the first issue of The New Messes, by a guest professor at my school when one of my writing gurus fell ill. And he liked the things I was doing. I had written, at the time I was writing on the cusp of going toward poetry, but I was writing short stories. And I'd written this one short story which repeated 6 times. And after the first one, every time it repeated, it omitted one of the vowels. So he liked that. He thought it was, you know, weird and everything. So he asked me to edit this anthology with somebody else. And that fell through. But as I was finally getting the, you know, guts to write to people I'd been impressed with for a couple of years, Raymond Fetterman sent me a lot of material. He was sending me like 4 pieces a week. And one of them was 50 pages. It was a play. And I told him that I liked it, but we couldn't obviously put it in an anthology. And he said, you know, well, it's been published in Austria, and it's not published in the US. And then I said, well, maybe we can change that. And I was being really gutsy, because I thought I could really become a publisher. And I'd never really thought of it much before that. And then at the same time, as I wanted to have some Oulipo members, because they're kind of the group or writers that had influenced me the most up to that point, I wanted to obviously ask, since I didn't know any translators from the French, I wanted to ask the only English members, English writing members, and it was Harry Matthews and Ian Monk. And I asked Ian Monk in an email why he didn't have a book of poetry published and if I could help him change that. And then you know, Family Archaeology came from that. And I thought that that was a really great book. So, and I think Kenneth Goldsmith's The Weather came from that too, from that anthology, and a section of it is in New Messes. But I think I wanted to, you know, publish books that I wanted to own, but that didn't exist, that were only in manuscript form, that were really experimental and doing things that weren't being done, you know, by others.
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit more generally about kind of what you're doing here in LA with LA artists and LA writers and poets, bringing them in to, you know, you said you're publishing a lot of LA poets for New Messes.
Well, I think when I started the press and when I was telling people, like, Paul Vangelisti took me on right after Ian Monk's book was published, and he was really happy that there was somebody publishing books in Los Angeles, and he was talking about how the Bay Area school, the Bay Area, you know, was way more known for poetry on the West Coast, and New York was way more known, and, you know, maybe I'm naive, you know, I thought we could maybe, you know, change that. I mean, LA is a lot bigger than, you know, those cities, and people are a lot more alienated, it seems, from each other. But I thought if we just, if I contacted writers and kept contacting them and we got together once a month or whatever, or once every 2 months, or at least had people meet, then people could talk about, oh, you know, those guys in LA, like those five people, or there's six people, or there's those 12 people. Because we have a lot of poets in LA, but some of them are in their 60s, some of them are in their 50s, they hang out in their own groups, you know. I don't know.
Do you feel anything's come from it yet?
I think so. People are talking about it a lot more, and I think with our reading series we're doing, you know, we're keeping it constant. So at first, it's been going on for a year and a half now. It started with Rob Roberge and Catherine Daly and I, and then now it's, you know, I co-curated with Stan Apps, who's right here, and at first we were missed skipping some months, you know, there were five people in the audience, and now it's like 20 to 50 a month. So that's great for poetry, you know, numbers. So I think so, and I think the more people hear about these things, oh, these readings happen all, you know, nonstop at the end of every month, then when they're visiting LA, they'll want to come and read here, or they'll come at the end of the month instead of the third week of the month to maybe do a reading here. So hopefully, I mean, why not? You know, there are lots of really great writers here.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, great. Well, we're here to talk about, like I said earlier, a series in the world, that book. So maybe before we just jump in, if you want to read maybe a section from the beginning.
Yeah. I'll read about half of the first piece, Series in the World. And, okay. Syria is in the world. Every person has two homelands. Syria is the cradle of civilizations. Civilizations emerged as the product of Syria's indigenous people. Others, civilizations, came from abroad, establishing contexts of exchange, reaching the most fertile interaction known to humanity. Thousands of archaeological sites attest that history is condensed in Syria, the greatest small country in the world. Syrian people are friendly and peaceful. All possible individual personalities and human beings hold in possession one, more than one, areas set aside to be a state for a people of a particular national, cultural, or racial origin. Syria is the most beautiful destination in the world. Syria made copper pliable. Syria's long, long history invented bronze. Syria's glory is not only in the present. If you are interested in history, then Syria is the most under-advertised important country in the world. Any visitor to Syria, where crime rate is low, will say the same thing. Syria is one of the most beautiful destinations. Syrian people are peaceful. Syrians were first to wear hand-weaved cotton and silk cloths. This is why, rightfully, Syria was called the cradle of civilizations. Modern man is indebted. Nature in Syria is very diverse. We are adding new pictures ranging from forests in the northwest, where there are an abundance of palaces, to beaches on Syria's Mediterranean coast, where there are an abundance of palaces, to Syria's breadbaskets in the northeast and the south, where there are an abundance of palaces. Syria's streets are among the world's safest. The crime rate is very low, and people wander the streets in Syria's nights. Syrian people are friendly. If you are interested in history and historical monuments, you cannot miss Syria. There is a monument around every corner. There is no civilization in the east or west throughout world history that didn't pass through Syria and leave a mark in Syria, as well as being affected by Syria. Syria's long, long history, a cradle for civilizations. food in Syria is very tasty and famous. Syria is often the largest small country in the world. Syria has a long, long history. The Bronze Civilization came. 10,000 years ago, agriculture began. Houses, not caves, became man's dwellings. We are adding new pictures and additional information. We will tell you here about the added sections when we add them. Syria is one of the destinations in the world. Today we still admire fabric. Syria is the cradle of the great civilization. The accomplishments of her ancients are renowned. Syrian people are friendly and peaceful. The Islamic conquest only confirmed Syria's Arab identity, gave a tent to the land. It was in Syria that soil was tamed, settlement commenced, civilization emerged. Journey through Syria is journey through time. Silk Road caravans were for carrying goods. Houses became man's dwellings. Man embarked on journey of self-discovery. He observed heaven and sang hymns, tried his hand at drawing and sculpture. These ancient arts are found all over Syria and on the riverbanks. You are interested in monuments. Syria also produced the world with another discovery. Copper was made pliable and bronze invented. The Bronze Civilization came. By the Euphrates and elsewhere, there was an abundance of palaces, temples, and murals reflecting cultural and commercial activity. Syria is in the world. Syria's visit is worth visiting the world. Human beings making up a group or linked by a common characteristic or interest, native to or inhabiting Syria, are not hostile, but in a state of calm and quiet. For thousands of years, this unrivaled geographical position was the main attraction for many civilizations. A journey of caravans from four directions to all destinations met at this place, allowing the fusion of most refined cultures with Syria's famous food. Therefore, its people got the tradition of hospitality and the warmth of the heart. Syrians gave scent to other lands. The Silk Road caravans were messengers for culture and science. Poets, scholars, travelers, musicians, and traders accompanied them, communicating together in Syria and creating relations between various identities, musicians, and traders, accepting each other and exchanging ideas between them. In the shadow of the bazaars, by the Euphrates and elsewhere, Syrian people are friendly and peaceful. The Khans, the men from everywhere, accompanied caravans communicating together in Syria and creating where they were able to dialogue and to enjoy the hospitality of the inhabitants of the blessed land of Syria. A journey through Syria, the silk weavers whom you see in Damascus, Hama, and Aleppo still work at their wooden handlooms just like their ancestors did in Ebla 4,000 years ago, is a journey through time. When you enter the old souks, you realize that history is time alive and tangible, moist clay, an alive alphabet. The Amorites, the Canaanites, the Phoenicians inhabited the coastal regions. The Aramaeans were the highlander. The Nabataeans inhabited the south. Syrian seafarers inhabited water with their enormous fleets with gleaming sails, enjoying Syria's lively summer nights from sea. Syrian skilled craftsmen changed the silk into wonderful poets, scholars, travelers, and musicians. Traders accompanied cloths, which are, until today, the most beautiful perfection in the art of textile. Syrians wore hand-weaved cotton and silk cloths. Veils worn by Palmyrian women, shown over the many statues, are made from those fabrics. History is tangible. You have an interest in history. You cannot miss Syria. Syria has monuments. The Euphrates is elsewhere. Modern man is now learning. Syria's streets are worlds. Syrian people are. Finally, food in Syria is very tasty and famous.
Thanks a lot.
That was great.
So I wanted to bring up a couple things about just that portion of Syria is in the world and see what you had to say about them. First and mostly is I noticed within the text the assertions that Syria is in the world, that Syria is the world, and in a sense Syria visits the world. And it's a very interesting sort of multifaceted view, this thing like spinning around and spinning around. And I wanted you to talk about Syria in terms of how it's viewed here. And
this is, I tutored for like 4 or 5 years, and one of the things you would always teach students when they were writing their essays was like to not state the obvious, right? Of course Syria is in the world. You wouldn't say like cigarette smoking is bad. You would argue why it's bad and why you should quit, you know, really. And so when I titled this piece and it had a section in it, when one of my friends read that, she's very emotional. She just started crying. And, you know, and I kind of put it in there just because I was messing around with this kind of found text in the Syrian tourism ministry. And I thought, oh, Syria is in the world. And she started, you know, she was crying and I was like, hey, relax, you know, what's your problem? And she said, you know, we often forget these things. And I thought, you know, that was, it would be good to title it this totally obvious thing. Well, of course, Syria is in the world. But I think this piece started with the invasion of Iraq and a little before. And as the U.S. was invading Iraq, they were also putting things in the media about how Syria supports terrorism and they have bad leaders. And this is true. I mean, the U.S. has bad leaders too. My grandma was born in Syria, in Aleppo, and she would always tell me, you know, that's my homeland. And I just couldn't really stand another 100,000 people dying because their leaders were bad or something, especially when they're not that bad, you know, in Syria. There are way worse people. It seemed, since Syria was one of the only countries that repeatedly stands up to the U.S. At the United Nations, that they just wanted to get rid of these leaders. I mention it over and over again because we always forget, we think of the Romans where our kind of civilization comes from, but like Syria is right there, and a lot of these cultures that we now hate, our kind of civilization comes from those cultures too, so.
Thus that every person has two homelands.
Oh yeah, and plus, you know, you're talking about how every person has a nationalism, and I'm bicultural, you know, like I was raised with this Armenian nationalism, and then growing up here, you get the America's great and stuff, and it was very easy to see that they weren't all always right. My parents weren't always right when they were like, Armenians are the greatest people in the world, and then, you know, because you have these multiple competing kind of absolutes. And so I wanted to also point out, because this is a part of a way longer work called World History, that every culture has a nationalism. Every culture, when it comes down to it, thinks they're the best. You know, and it's really beautiful when you put it next to, when you put these competing nationalisms next to each other, and you see that in the end, like Noam Chomsky's breaking down of George Bush's State of the Union address and Osama bin Laden's reaction to it the next day, that they're pretty much saying the same thing, coming from different, you know, sides.
This reminds me, and this is an odd tangent, this reminds me of like a, it's an article published by Mark Twain in a newspaper. I don't remember what newspaper, but he was saying how, like, it's basically like saying, you know, God is on our side, and then saying about the other people that God is on our side, you know, and in the end it became absurd, like, that whether it be claiming a religious kind of progenitor or whatever for nationalism, or just claiming, like, our country is the greatest, our lands are the greatest, you know, it's almost, we can all claim some sort of, you know,
yeah,
some sort of nationalism, right?
It's just, we have to make ourselves feel good.
Yeah.
And, you know, religion and our bonds to our nation, they're like the easiest.
So, Stephanie and I were talking before coming in today about how, I mean, I was kind of saying that I feel almost like sometimes in this piece, Syria's in the world, like you could substitute the word Lebanon for Syria and the piece would be really similar, unless someone really knew that much about Syria. It's like a lot of the stuff is kind of vague, but I mean it's general, a lot of the stuff.
But then
we might disagree.
Yeah,
but
I didn't want that to be true. I don't know if it is true, but
I don't think I think Lebanon would have its own narrative that,
yeah,
you know, because I don't think, like, okay, America, let's say like Lebanon and Syria are close, but you couldn't put America is in the world. I mean, that would,
yeah,
be true, but you couldn't claim America invented the alphabet.
Right, right.
You know, everyone's like, is, you know, so, but I think every culture has its own really unique little story,
yeah,
that's really funny in a way when you, you know, and I like this piece, but I'm also critiquing that kind of, I think, rhetoric.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking it seemed in a way that, like, until you get to some of the later parts of it, that like it kind of evokes a general image of Syria, but it's, if someone doesn't know that much about Syria, you know, they get a very like kind of almost a misty version of what Syria is. They don't, you know, it's like, it's,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, most people in America don't know that much about the Middle East, so you could substitute any Middle Eastern country for Syria is in the world, and it would probably work.
Yeah.
Even a landlocked country, and you would talk about the seafarers and all this, and people would be like, oh.
Yeah, right. So they would believe those great ships with white sails could be from...
Gleaming, yeah.
Which, regarding specific details of information, maybe you could speak to how you made this piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. I took it from... Obviously, it's mutilated. I took it from the Syrian Tourism Ministry website and a couple of other sections. Like... One of the next things I might read has another source, but it's funny because when you think of plagiarism, you think of like directly taking it without altering it, which I do in other places. But this one took, you know, 9 months to a year and a half to really get to the point where I felt like I had it. I mean, it was actually like 40 something pages before, with other short story narratives going through that were written by my own hand. And then I had to take those out and just rework it and make sentences sound absurd or repeat passages over and over again. But yeah, it is from this narrative that invites you to visit and you know, buy a ticket to Syria to see all the great things there. And it ends with, finally, food in Syria is tasty and famous, because I think, and someone else pointed this out to me, it's just one of the ways we understand another culture is by their food. You know, like you have these fairs on university campuses and it's like, oh, Peruvian food. Oh, Filipino food. Oh yeah, that culture is so great. Their food is so tasty. Have you tried Ethiopian food?
Yeah. So we consume cultures by like consuming food. I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, I do that myself. I love going to pho down on Western, you know.
Yeah, and then, you know, and it's like, Vietnamese, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's Vietnamese food. Most of the places are run by Koreans. So it's, you know, it's like, what am I getting? I don't know, but it tastes good. So, yeah, it's very tasty and famous.
It's like, oh, Ara, have you tried that one Armenian restaurant? It's like, no. They had belly dancers, and it's like, oh, you know, Armenians don't really have belly dancing unless they were, you know, come from the Middle East, and anyway, long story.
Speaking of consumption, though, you did want to talk a little bit about the Charles Bernstein. And...
Well, yeah, I think a lot of the poems in this piece, and a lot of the ways I think I write, since I stopped writing short stories because I was tired of directly getting across an idea, and the short stories that I was writing eventually ended up sounding like Syrias in the world that were really just off-putting and everything. And so I think, you know, Charles Bernstein has this great passage where, and I'll read from it, in
his
essay, The State of the Art from A Poetics. Too often, the works selected to represent cultural diversity are those that accept the model of representation assumed by the dominant culture in the first place. He goes on to say, I see my grandpa on the hill next to the memories I can never recapture, is becoming kind of like the baseline where you can substitute other identities. You know, like I see my Yiddish mama on Hester Street. I see my grandmother on the hill next to all the mothers whose lives can never be recaptured, or I can't touch my iron father, who never canoed with me on the prairies of my masculine epiphany. And he goes on to say, works that challenge these models of representation run the risk of becoming more inaudible than ever within mainstream culture. I wanted to write texts that weren't easily palatable, you know, like where, I mean, once I wrote this story about a relative of mine, all in the present tense, and it was strange already, you know, because it's like, he's doing this, he is doing this, and he sprains his ankle getting doing a hit for a mobster in Armenia, and then he realizes this is no future, there's no future in this for him. So he calls his brother up in America, all in present tense, and the brother buys him a ticket so he can come and work here for 2 years, and he goes back, and within a year he spent all the money, his house is half remodeled, and he's back in the same position where the van he bought so he can tax people around is always breaking down, and he always has to call back to America to ask for money. And it was this really messed up story about, you know, other countries and, you know, U.S. domination. And some guy in the class, after reading it, came to class and was like, man, Ara, you know, this story made me feel so proud to be American because, you know, look at all these people coming here to work because this country is so great. And I felt like I was like, Jesus, you know, you missed. And I was like, what is my message? You know, I was obviously trying to get something, you know, I don't know. It drives me crazy.
Do you think Syria in the world addresses those issues in some?
Hopefully. I mean, I have these things I won't do. You know, like, I have these ways where I won't write a poem in that way. If I write, like, a poem that gets across my, you know, who I am, or, like, growing up in the Soviet Union, there'll be short fragments, like, in my I Remember sections that are with other fragments that offset them. But I know what I won't do, like, and it's harder to, you know, kind of work with what I want to do and finding those. And I hopefully when this book comes out, it'll be a little longer than it is right now, and it'll be some of my attempts. I don't know.
Well, Stephanie and I were also talking about how some of the language in here, like, it's very concrete. It's not like convoluted, poetic, you know, getting at poetic meanings, it's like it evokes this very dreamy place, you know. I mean, maybe it's because of the source text where it came from, but some of the things like people walk through the streets at night in Syria, you know, just it evokes like this kind of dreamy land, this mm-hmm. world that you've created.
I mean, you would have a very, very safe country if people would be immediately murdered if they committed a crime or immediately punished. You know, I mean, of course you would have a really safe, of course you're the safest in the world. You'd get your hand cut off if you stole something. I mean, not that they do that in Syria, I'm not gonna, but of course, you know, no one's gonna mess with you.
Yeah. Well, do you wanna read maybe the next piece, like Arms in Arms Through Syria, or Worth Remember? Maybe if you want to do a little quick coda to the series in the world.
Yeah, I'll read Worth Remember, which is somewhere else. This is actually Worth Remember is a couple of the Syria is in the world texts combined, and a 2% summary of. 2% summary of them through Microsoft Word summary program.
One of the best little programs that Microsoft has made.
And I think it was like 5%, but this is the best it came out with. So it was called 5% of Syria at first, but it changes. It's the last section of this because most of the poems in the book aren't about Syria.
Right.
They're about, you know. So this kind of closes off the Syria section. Worth Remember. Syria is beautiful. Syria's long, long history. Syria has monuments. In 1967, Syria lost. Syria professed loyalty. Syria over Lebanon. Syria has maintained. Hands through Syria. Syria was recorded. Syria was Roman. That's it.
That's the short version.
That's the short version.
Should publish a one-page chapbook. No, I'm kidding. Do you want to read Arms in Arms Through Syria, though?
Kind of I'll read a quarter of it.
Okay. Sure.
And this is, I don't know how true this is, but I tried to include the entire history of Syria, you know, its conquests and all, in four short paragraphs. And it starts. Okay, I'll start at the beginning then. So this is Arms in Arms Through Syria. All of time is present. It is 1920 AD and France is granted mandate over Syria and Lebanon by the League of Nations. Syria's nationalism is more determined and shifts from anti-Turkish sentiment to anti-French sentiment. It is 1920 and 1925 through 1927 AD, and the French move to quell armed rebellions with more arms. It is 1938 AD, and France refuses to ratify a treaty towards Syrian independence. Syria's history is long and full of such instances. It is 1939 AD, and France cedes ancient Antioch to Turkey. Syrian's hostility is raised to new pitch. The pitch is trebly and hurts ears. World War II arrives. Syria sides with France and allies. It is 1940 AD, and France falls. It is 1940 AD, and Vichy government controls Syria. It is 1941 AD, and British and French forces subdue Syria. It is 1941 AD, and Free French government recognizes Syria's independence. It is 1943 AD, and the new government in Syria is Syrian. Syria's long, long history is Syrian. It is 1946 AD, and British troops leave Syria. Syria becomes a charter member of United Nations. May history's silver eyes write truth and erase lies. Syria is able to see history at once and completely. It is 1516 AD, and the Turks incorporate Syria and surrounding regions into their empire. The Ottomans grip Syria for four centuries. It is 1869 AD, and Syria's commercial importance as site of trade routes to Asia is diminished with the opening of the Suez Canal. It is 1914 through 1918 AD. The First World War begins, and Syrian nationalist movements hold parts of Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire becomes Turkey through the perpetration of several genocides. Turkey sides with Central Powers. Allies promise Syrians independence if they rebel against Turkey. Great Britain and France secretly decide that Syria and most Arab lands will be divided into British and French spheres. History documents countless lies and deceits. Western words will no longer carry honor for patriarchs in the Arab deserts. Stop there.
Yeah, that's great. The last line, Western words will no longer carry honor for patriarchs in the Arab deserts, seems to be true.
It's like double critical.
Well, one of the things that if I can just read a couple lines from that section, and this also happens in Syria as in the world, but through certain kinds of repetition, an idea, you know, changes a little bit in kind of in this series, in the world piece, and in other pieces that you do. But just from the beginning of each of the section, Arms and Arms Through Syria, all of time is present. Syria is able to see history at once and completely. Syria is a long, long history. History in Syria is something living. It is time which in Syria is always present. So that was something I was really interested in, and it, not just in that piece, but throughout the entire kind of series in the world opus. Time becomes very fluid and completely interconnected. I mean, although in those poems, Arms and Arms Through Syria, you're kind of stepping back in little chunks of time, you do get the feeling that time is coincident, always, right?
I mean, and I'm sorry to be completely going back to the political aspects of this, but this whole, all of the Syria pieces started because of the Bush presidency. But, you know, it's completely moronic to say they hate us for our freedom, obviously. Mm-hmm. If you read history at all, you realize some of the people that we're talking about who hate us for our freedom have been totally oppressed for hundreds and hundreds of years by Western powers. And it's not our freedom they hate, it's just the continuation of it. You know, we say the end of imperialism and all these things, but it's never, you know, you don't teach American school children that imperialism, you know, is still going on and that we still have colonies. You have different words for it, but to people who have to live with it every single day, it's a completely different story. So it's my own part, you know, hopefully people will read it and it's not, you know, it's slightly experimental, so hopefully that message can come across.
It brings up a new, just what you said right now, though, previously to that, I've been thinking that regarding time, it's almost mystical the way it works in the first part and in the second part, which are very different, just even form on the page for people that can't see it. The second part is all caps and bold and less gentle. So, I mean, I had been reading the time stretching and and being pinched back in again is this kind of mystical thing. But in a way, it seems like you're pointing to an irresponsibility that specifically Americans have regarding the history of other countries. And
you know, yeah. I think that's really close. I just wanted to show in this one just the different people that have occupied this land we call Syria, and how really, really dense, you know, the whole history of Syria is, and how you can't really dismiss it as like this country that hates us or what. Plus, there are lots of people, innocent people, who have no control over what goes on, and they're including in America.
Another thing on.
Hello. Hello. Here we are.
Yeah, right. Another thing on this point is where you kind of say things like in the main section of Syria's in the world, you say things like history is condensed in Syria. In Syria, history is tangible. A journey through Syria is a journey through history.
Or time
is a journey through time. And so, I mean, I was really interested in the way that works. I mean, history being condensed. I mean, even in the first section, I got the feeling that every moment of Syria's history was evident at every moment. And, you know, again, maybe I'm belaboring the point, but I just thought that was a really interesting technique, or good technique. Yeah, so congratulations.
Good job.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, good work. One other thing that I want to talk about, just kind of generally on Syria's in the world, is a type of thing you do, and this kind of shows a little bit the method that you use to make the poem, is when you say things like, we are adding new sections, or we are adding new pictures here. We will tell you about them when they have been added. And I wonder if you can talk about like building in the process to the actual poetry a little bit.
I just thought that was really funny, because the website didn't seem like it had been updated for a couple of years, and it seemed like that message was there from like 2 years ago. And
those are like the lost islands of the internet, right? This page will be updated from 97 or...
You know, I love the websites done by... I don't want to be, patronizing. I love websites, sometimes visiting them and seeing that, you know, they've run the text and through a translator into English, and it's really awkward, and I think it's beautiful. You know,
yeah.
I love it. I love English. You know, you can stretch it so far and still get your ideas across.
It's a very pliable language.
Yeah.
Okay.